Welcome to the Modern Practice Podcast, where you get a special curbside consult from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and on recent podcasts, we've been hearing from the front lines in the battle against COVID-19. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Tom Spiegel at University of Chicago Medicine to learn what this busy emergency department is doing there and one of the biggest epicenters of the coronavirus outbreak. My colleague, Lindsay Mayer, Senior Director of Vizient's Collaborative Program, recently held a special webinar with Dr. Spiegel, and here's what they shared.
Dr. Tom Spiegel is currently the Emergency Department Medical Director, so I want to turn it over right away. Dr. Spiegel, the floor is now yours.
Okay, thank you very much. So this presentation that I'm going to discuss talks about what we're doing at University of Chicago, as well as I've been in touch with just numerous academic medical centers in Chicago, as well as across the country, and just trying to find out what they're doing, what everyone is doing, sharing ideas and sharing best practices and trying to learn from each other. One thing that's very obvious is that there is just the spectrum of preparedness goes across the entire gamut, from very well prepared and funded and to not prepared and learning as much as people possibly can. So I think that if depending upon where you're at on the spectrum, I can guarantee you you're not alone. And I think there's many resources out there to help you. Even if you're completely prepared, I do think that there's still things that you can learn from each other. So I'm going to continue on with that sharing. So University of Chicago Medicine, we just to give a little bit of demographic information, we have 811 licensed beds, many other treatment areas. Our emergency departments between the adult and pediatric sees about a little bit over 110,000 patients a year. University of Chicago Medicine, we actually had a unique situation in that we had researchers, in fact, our hospital epidemiologist had done research and worked in Wuhan, China, with a couple different hospitals. So they had connections, and in early in late December, early January, we heard some very bad news coming out of there, as everyone is now aware. So our HICS command, actually, we decided to set up early. The third week of January, we had meetings where it was decided to fully activate HICS, and on January 27th, we had our very first full HICS committee with the entire structure in place. And since then, we've been preparing and continuing to adapt our preparations, as I'll continue to talk through. In the coming weeks, we do anticipate, as I'm sure all of you do, increased demand for our medical care, especially in the EDs and the ICUs. Some things we've done recently in the past week is that we did open up a drive-through clinic and also a dedicated COVID clinic, so patients can call ahead of time, be triaged on the phone, go to the drive-through clinic. If they're clinically not well, they'll be pulled out of the line and go to the dedicated COVID clinic. Otherwise, they'll continue on the drive-through, get swabbed, and then called with results later. We also expanded our ED into some of our surge spaces. I know a lot of places are setting up tents. We don't have a tent right now. That's our last stage of expansion. Our first stage included expanding into one of our administrative areas, which was right next to our emergency department. And I'll talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. But within our ED, then we created what we call our hot and cool zones. The hot zones are negative pressure rooms where we're putting our patients with ILI that were concerned for COVID. And then the cool zones would be anyone who does not have an ILI. They're not fixed zones. Those 11 beds within our hot zone is the permanent hot zone, but we do flex that space as we need to. One of the things we're working on right now is a robust physician backup system. As we have many surgeries being canceled and clinics being canceled, there are procedure lists, there are other physicians. You know, anyone who is a physician or an advanced practitioner and provider, we are seeking their opinions and their comfort levels and volunteers to see where else can they be deployed if need be. In the meantime, then, we're developing SOPs and training materials for any of our non-ED docs to help out in some of our low acuity or our ILI areas. So some of the themes that were discussed earlier, I'm just going to kind of give thoughts on from our perspective. The surge plan, one of the biggest things that we tried to do in the surge plan as part of a surge plan is to, you know, it's the whole prevention is the best medicine, is to try to prevent people from coming onto campus. We've deployed a robust telemedicine program, which we've also identified that if we have to quarantine providers for any exposures or concerns, yet they're healthy, we're asking them to assist with some of the telemedicine visits. As I mentioned, we opened a COVID clinic with drive-through testing. Another part of the surge plan is really assessing, as has already been discussed from Lifespan, assessing your inpatient capacity, your ICU capacities, your vents. Some of the information that we received early on from Wuhan was that a lot of these patients were ending up on ECMO. I haven't heard as much discussion on that from the states, but that is something that we did a full assessment of early on to see what are our ECMO teams made of, who are on the teams, what are their capabilities, what other options do we have for additional ECMO. And of course, supply chain, PPE is always a concern, as it has been discussed earlier. pharmacy, and also work in conjunction with your local SNFs to have a place to send these patients once they're either getting better or are negative yet have other things going on to make space within your hospital. Within our ED, the biggest component of our surge is that we put a nursing triage right at the door, and patients are asked before they enter the emergency department if they have any influenza-like illness. If they do and they're well-appearing, then they're immediately taken down about 100 yards, literally down the same building, into the next door where we have what we call level 1.5. It's an administrative area that was not yet finished. It was fairly finished, but not inhabited. So it was empty space where we set chairs 6 feet apart from each other. We had our plant folks build temporary negative pressure rooms that we could do COVID testing. And for well-appearing patients who need the testing, we do RVP and COVID, and then we discharge them and call them with results. So that space we opened up this last weekend. We're fully using that space this week. And that's what's preventing us from, or at least what's saving us for the time being, from having to pursue any kind of a tent structure outside of the emergency department. And we have about 30 areas where patients can wait 6 feet apart from each other. As far as PPE conservation, that's going to become, it is an important, but it's going to become an even increasingly important topic, as everyone is aware. Another thing, and I think this has already been mentioned from our colleagues at Lifespan, that we had a similar experience in that the public was taking a lot of our PPE. So the cough stations that were by many of the doors where there were masks and Purell, people would walk up and grab handfuls of the masks and walk away. We saw the same thing in our emergency department. So we pulled all the cough stations, pulled all of the hallway stations where we had PPE. Now it's all being managed clinically by the charge nurses within each unit, because we were even concerned about folks on staff taking too much of the PPE or using too much of the PPE. So now it's being managed much closer. One other thing in terms of PPE conservation and also just employee protection is limiting entry into any rooms, whether this be in the emergency department or on the inpatient side. We're making extensive use of phones, so we can discuss things with the patient ahead of time in terms of history of illness, go in there, conduct an exam, leave the room, and then have any follow-up conversations or any follow-up instructions via phone. So we're trying to limit the amount of time that we spend within the patient room with either phones, and then I know some areas are using video conferencing as well. In terms of visitor restriction, I think from what I'm hearing across the country in many different states, in many different healthcare systems, this is very commonplace now. Our policy is that no visitors are on the inpatient side, on the inpatient floors, except for end-of-life care, and those exceptions are made on a case-by-case basis. In the ED and the clinics, patients can bring one support person with them, but that's it, and then no one under the age of 18 unless they're an ED patient. And then finally, the forward triage, which is somewhat I've already mentioned, the forward triage being pushing that nurse. I know some healthcare systems like Rush University, we met with yesterday, they have a provider up in their forward triage to be able to assess patients and to make that determination of ILI, and if it is ILI, are you sick or not sick? We have a patient arriving ambulatory, patients arrive via EMS. They get screened right at the door. And if the patient has an ILI, the influenza-like illness, if they don't, then we just discontinue the pathway, resume normal care. Now, within this pathway, symptoms are fever, cough, sore throat, body aches, and diarrhea. And I'd encourage you to think about discussing this with your staff. Don't discount just simply diarrhea. We just had a recent patient test positive for COVID whose only complaint was diarrhea. So that is certainly something to consider. So if the patient does have an ILI, really it boils down to, are they well-appearing and does the nurse think they're going to be eventually discharged, or are they really sick and do they need more advanced care? And that comes into play later in the pathway. Both streams follow the same initial pathway, which is that staff needs to make sure that we're protected, gown, gloves, eye protection, surgical mask. We ensure that the patient has on a surgical mask on the patient. And if they're unable to wear a mask, then we actually have tents that we put over the patient if we need to. The companion, they get one companion, everyone else has to go away. We have a social work consult team dedicated to COVID. They'll help explain that. Our security folks help enforce our visitor policy. And then we order isolation right off the bat. Then to the next stage, ILI patients, whether they're sick or not sick, if we just broadly classify them. We isolate them, we notify our team that these patients are here, and then again, we prevent unnecessary entry into the rooms unless involved in direct patient care. And then we also obtain the patient's phone number, so we ensure that we have that for any test results, as well as to communicate with them while they're in the emergency department. So this then is the big decision point. Does the patient need admission? And if it's a no, the patient can be discharged. Well, before we go forward, we've expanded the early CDC criteria of simply a known COVID contact and recent travel to a known COVID area, to include criteria such as, are you a healthcare worker? Do you have end-stage renal and dialysis? Are you living in close quarters, which would be a dormitory, barracks, homeless shelter? Are you immunocompromised? Do you have significant comorbidities? The significant comorbidities that we are using are fairly broad at this point. They include things such as any type of cardiac disease, including hypertension. It also includes diabetes, which if you talk about hypertensive diabetics in the emergency department, it's almost rare to not have one of those two and present to an emergency department. So a lot of patients that are healthy, otherwise appearing, who have ILIs, will have some type of significant comorbidity as we're defining that. If they do not, they simply get ordered Tamiflu, they're tested, and then we call them within the next day to say whether or not they had anything positive and if they should begin their Tamiflu. If they did have any of these medical conditions or any of those criteria, then we go ahead and order the RVP as well as the COVID. We collect the RVP, and then basically we discharge the patient, and we call the patient back with the results. University of Chicago Medicine is in a unique, fairly unique, not solely unique, but a lucky and unique position in having in-house testing for COVID. So that's the well-appearing discharge patients, whether they get COVID tested or not. If the patient is ill-appearing, then we do collect an RVP. If we do need to get any chest imaging, early on that we had the CT as part of the protocol, but I think most places, including the radiology societies, are saying you don't need to do that. So unless they need a CT, we don't get the CT. If we do, then we have a SOP for imaging. Then the nurse collects the RVP results. If the RVP is negative, then we go ahead and get the COVID test going, as well as calling the inpatient team to admit the patient. If the RVP is positive with flu A, flu B, RSV, or pneumo, then we just release the whole COVID aspect and admit the patient. If it's not positive for one of those, then we go ahead with COVID and then admit the patient. And then finally, follow-up discharge instructions for those leaving, more of a pathway, what we do further as we're preparing for admission. So if they're very ill and need the ICU, we call the ICU team. If it's going to the floor, then we call our hospitalist team. And we are dedicating those patients are being assigned exclusively to a team of the hospitalists. We're not cohorting on the inpatient side at this point. We do have several dozen patients that are being ruled out, although those discussions are very active and taking place right now. And then finally, we admit the patient. So this is simply the emergency department pathway. Then this transitions to an inpatient pathway where the same kind of logic is outlined, all approved by our ID and IC teams and our HICS command, and this all continues throughout the course and duration of their care. So stepping back and saying, well, you know, most of the time during the day, I'm at the hospital doing HICS meetings. Sometimes on the floor on the front lines, I've got shifts this upcoming weekend. But in the evenings, it's catching up on email and then catching up with some peers across the country. So just wanted to share some of the learnings that I've seen, and hopefully they're helpful for you. Again, I've already mentioned that there's a spectrum of preparedness, and the approaches and preparations vary wildly. I don't think anyone has the one answer. There are some institutions that I think are leading fantastic examples. I do think, though, that one of the things that most places are doing, and I think is a very good idea to try to consider and do it as much as you can, is to divide your emergency department into the ILI patients and the non-ILI patients. We have these hot and cool zones in the emergency department with dedicated pathways identified. So we would never take a COVID suspect, a PUI, through just a general area. We have a dedicated area, a dedicated walkway that we walk back to the hot zone. Shortages in supplies are appearing, and there's many threads and discussions about, of course, PPE. We know about that. Some areas are running short on blood. We're lucky to not have that situation. I've seen several discussions about propofol shortages and MDI shortages. So I'm sure those are unique to each individual institution, but those are the four areas that I've heard multiple discussions at multiple locations, and I just wanted to highlight those. So as you take a look at your stock, make sure that things aren't running too low. One group in Seattle sends all high-risk symptomatic patients not needing admission home with a thermometer, a pulse ox, and an app where they're followed every 4 hours and then every day from a nurse for checkups. I thought that was great. We don't have that infrastructure, but boy, what a great practice. The Washington experience, the American College of Emergency Physicians out in Washington, some of their leaders got together last week and wrote up a summary of what they've experienced. It's very interesting. I think many other hospitals in the country are where they were at the time of the writing of this. So one, I think one takeaway is that you're not alone. And the second one is that it does offer some hope as they're continuing to struggle and see patients and care for themselves. Again, you're not alone, and they're getting by, but here's some thoughts from their perspective.
So it looks like we have just a few minutes left. We got a lot of questions here. So let's go ahead and dig into just a few. So are you focusing, you know, more on continuous 24-hour infusions rather than intermediate infusions?
We've discussed combining orders so that it could minimize entry into the room. I don't think we've gone to full 24-hour infusions of anything.
The drive-through clinics and the COVID clinics, how do you determine who to swab?
The patients that are directed to go to the drive-through clinic are pre-screened by when they call in to the clinics for an appointment. They'll be screened. If it's only for COVID, then they get directed right to get swabbed. So it's all pre-screened. And it's basically ILI illnesses, much like the ED pathway I presented.
Are you cohorting patients in one unit?
We are not. It's funny that you ask now because I just received an email saying what I said earlier is that we're admitting them all to a single hospitalist team that is now overwhelmed and they're starting to disperse among teams. And we're still discussing cohorting, but there's not been any active cohorting at this point.
There are many questions around changing treatment in the ED for common respiratory disease, such as asthma, moving away from nebulized meds to MDIs, even when there are no other symptoms that would indicate a viral infection or risk of COVID. Thoughts on this?
Yeah, we're moving towards that same thing. In fact, there were very active discussions this morning that an MDI and a spacer, as many of us practitioners know, there's plenty of research to support that that is just as effective as a neb. Patients like nebs, though. So in terms of benefit to the patient, they're really equivocal. I think that there's just a preference from the patients that a lot of providers kind of bend to. I think it's time to stay firm and stick with the albuterol and MDIs.
Great. Thank you.
Our thanks to Lindsay Mayer and Dr. Spiegel for their look at what this large emergency department is doing to treat patients and keep staff protected during this time of crisis. I sincerely hope this glimpse into the efforts of one organization to battle COVID-19 will both inspire and inform you in your own efforts. And please join us for other podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.